You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Montokungua. E whakarongo ana koe ki te waia maronga irirangi poho mō tēnei rā tērā o Ruatekaumarima o Pōtu Te Rangi. Kia ora, you tuned into the Thursday Wire here on 95BFM for today, rāpere the 25th of March. It's Justin here, and I am very glad that you can join me on this day. It's nearly April, and time is really flying by. But I'm still here on my own in the studio, my producer. I still don't have a producer, so. But we still have a full show today. FIKNA, we have our regular updates with Health and Pike River Reentry Minister Andrew Little. Skypath at Auckland's Harbour Bridge is all but cancelled because of structural problems, and I had a chat with Bike Auckland's chair, Barb Cuthbert, about this. Meanwhile, I spoke to local government New Zealand's president, Stuart Crosby, about the government's decision to strip local authorities of their water fluoridation powers and give it to the Director General of Health. And hopefully we will have Associate Health Minister, Dr. Aisha Viral, to talk about this live on air. As always, let me know your thoughts on all the issues. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text me on 5395 or waimairane, call me on 309 3879. Kua e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano hei pakihiri rokiroki maronga i te paitutu, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM ira katikom. And as always, you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. I tēnei wā tonu. Let's get into the show.
Tell me you love me and beg me to stay. Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
The government last week it is amending a current bill that shifts water fluoridation decision making from local authorities to local DHBs and give the power to the Director General of Health. And on the line right now is Associate Health Minister Dr. Aisha Viral. Kia ora, Minister.
Kia ora, Justin.
Why is the government proposing this?
These decisions about fluoride, which are really important for people's dental health, particularly children, we want them to be made consistently. And a way to do that is to give the decision making to the Director General, who is of course a health expert, and take it away from politicians.
But why not give it to local DHBs where they have the local knowledge of what is actually going on?
Well, so it's the main thing is that the Director General can take local factors into account, like the feasibility of the particular water supply infrastructure and how hard or easy it is to put fluoride into it. So local factors still matter, but the thing is the science of how much fluoride helps prevent dental decay is going to be consistently applied across the country.
And who will bear the cost and to administer the fluoridation after the law change?
Yeah, so of course half the country already fluoridates its water, and in that situation the local councils do that. For the majority of cases that will remain the same, we have a small fund available that could support small water suppliers coming on with any capital expenditure they need to do to start fluoridation, and that's something we'll be over time releasing the criteria for accessing that.
Right. I know you're busy. You have other meetings. So my final question will be, what about non-council rural water supplies like wells or tank water? Will they be subjected to the same fluoridation standards?
No, and that's what I mean. It's not feasible to do every tiny water supply, so that is an issue. And those people need to seek health advice to see if there's an alternative like tablets for them.
Dr. Viral,
and of course brush their teeth twice a day with fluoridated toothpaste.
Right. Dr. Viral, thank you very much for joining the show.
Thanks, Justin. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And that was Associate Health Minister Dr. Aisha Viral. And now we will hear from Local Government New Zealand's President Stuart Crosby. I talked to him about the government's decision earlier this morning, and I began by asking what he thought about this move.
Well, we actually asked for that process to be removed from council some time ago. Local government believed that type of, frankly, mass medication had to be a national decision as opposed to a local decision. In my own council here in Tauranga City years ago, we held two referendums to decide whether fluoride should remain in at that point and be taken out. And the answer was from the community for it to be taken out. But it's incredibly controversial and very difficult for a council to make an on-balance decision, because you could get five acclaimed international expert reports to say fluoride is good for you, and you could get another five to say that it's unhealthy for you. So it's a very difficult situation for a council to make.
But by giving the water fluoridation's powers back to the central government, won't it take away local input?
Yes, it does. In terms of local decision-making, you're quite correct. But on majority, our sector felt that is a matter of health, and that high-level health issue should and must be taken by the government of the day, but more importantly, take accountability and responsibility for that decision. And that's where local councils always struggled in terms of getting that expert opinion consensus on this. So it was a real difficulty for local councils to make a local decision, generally often with input from the community. It was highly divisive, and there was no clear mandate from a community.
Okay, I kind of want to now talk about how water fluoridation is conducted now at local levels. So is it expensive for territorial authorities like city councils to fluoridate their own water supply?
There is a cost, but I wouldn't describe it as a big cost. when we did have it in the council I was on, it was basically a mixing machine and a small pump that put the appropriate level of fluoride into the system. So yes, there is a cost, but in terms of the overall cost of producing healthy water, it wasn't a big cost.
Do you know if under the new regulations, by giving the water fluoridation powers back to the Ministry of Health, is the cost going to be bared by local authorities or the central government?
Well, that's an interesting question. That's not clear yet. Many councils do already, of course, have fluoridation into their water supplies. I don't know the exact number, but I do know a number do. So for them, it's just business as usual. So that would be an interesting debate as to when councils that don't have it, or even the existing councils have it, who should pay. But bear in mind, there's a big debate going on in New Zealand at the moment about councils potentially shifting their water supplies to bigger water entities from 67 at the moment down to about 3 or 4. That's one issue. The other issue is, of course, we have some 800,000 to a million New Zealanders who are not on a council supply, you know, in rural and provincial New Zealand. And so, you know, what's going to happen to them?
That's interesting. I'm sure there will be another time to talk about this topic. But going to right at the beginning, you said water fluoridation is very divisive on the local level. And especially we have seen recently a lot of conspiracy theories coming up surrounding water fluoridation. Is it difficult for local authorities to handle this and send out correct information?
It is. It's incredibly difficult because, as I said, you can get world-renowned expert reports to say fluoridation is good for people's health, dental health in particular, obviously. And then you can get another five to say that in the long term it is detrimental to your health. So again, incredibly difficult for councils to inform their own communities on either the risks or benefits of fluoridation. And so that's one of the other reasons why it's best made at the national level, and at the national decision-making process, those people are made accountable and responsible for that decision.
In your time as Tauranga City Council, or maybe other city councils as general, have you seen any decisions to fluoridate water getting reversed because anti-fluoride advocates got elected to the territorial authorities?
Not recently, no. I haven't been aware of any recent debate around councils choosing to fluoridate their water or remove fluoride from their water supplies. This debate goes way back to the 1960s, actually, and I haven't seen one particularly over the last, gosh, five years, possibly 10 years. So at the moment, it's been in limbo,
Great.
The decision-making process.
And that was Local Government New Zealand's President Stuart Crosby talking about the government's decision to shift water fluoridation powers from local authorities to the Director General of Health. Let me know what you think. You can let me know. You can text 5395 or call me on 309379. The time is 19 past noon. You're listening to the Thursday Wire on 95BFM. We will be going on a quick break.
Beautiful, yeah. Beyond is taking the future of mobility and hitting you over the head with it. The Lavelle Smart Helmet. Redefining your safety with mapping directions, podcasts, indicators, hands-free calling, radio. It'll even text your mum where you are if you bail. Comfort, convenience, safety, and it looks pretty cool too. Bikes and Beyond. Your local for future mobility solutions. Specialists in e-bikes and e-transport solutions since 2012. Common Unity Builder Better World activist since birth. Stores in Newmarket, Devonport and Waiheke Island.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler? I don't know.
Okay, what about treasure trunks and six?
Speedos. I don't know. What does this even mean?
Shit, you're useless.
Oh!
Don't you know anything?
Well, it may be useless, but I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club, there's a tribute to Outkast by members of Avondale Bowling Club and Yokozuna.
Oh, and tomorrow?
Miguel BD, followed by Kilimanjaro and Chip Matthews.
Sweet as! One of those actually solved 13 across.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Auckland Craft Beer and Food Festival hits Spark Arena this Saturday, March 27th. New Zealand's best craft brewers and artisan food trucks at the country's largest urban beer garden, featuring legendary Kiwi acts including Zed, Hello Sailor, Molly and the Chromatics, Anika Moore and Nice and Ehrlich. Kicks off at 1pm. Tickets from aucklandbeerfestival.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Durbidge, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
You're listening to 95BFM. This is Justin Wong with the Thursday Wire. It's 25 past noon. Now let's hear from the Beehive.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the government setting to announce the first changes to the health system next month and his comments around not going further into the Pike River mine. Here's the Minister. I kind of want to start this week by talking about the health system reform.
Sure.
You said in a speech yesterday there are going to be five key shifts in reforming the system. So what are these shifts?
There's a number of them, obviously. One is greater equity. Another is making sure that equity in the sense of not just access for communities that are underserved by the system, Māori, Pacifica, disabled, but actually across the country, knowing that your access to healthcare is not going to be dependent on, you know, where you live, that we get a consistency of treatment across the country. Another is compliance with the Treaty of Waitangi. Another is better use of data and digital technology. We know with COVID, a lot more people, when they were consulting their doctor or even other health professionals, they could do a lot more through telehealth and through just conveying, you know, their relevant data through other means. So there's a lot more of that. Those are principal ones, but the idea is that there's means and technology available now that means we can do health differently. We're behind many other countries, and we're determined to make up that gap.
You described this announcement next week as a, quote, blueprint for how the system will work in the future. What do you mean by this? Is it a change on the organisation or down to a little bit of finer detail on how services are provided?
Yeah, we're due to make the announcement next month. It'll be April before we announce the detail. But yeah, this is really looking at the structure of the system to make sure that we're getting the coherence and consistency. We've got a lot of DHBs, increasing the DHBs are working together, working across their own sort of boundaries, because they realise that, you know, patients in one region, if they can't get their treatment in one hospital, they've got to be able to go to another. But I think the other is recognising that we do have a big gap when it comes to primary and community care, which is actually where most people get their health care, and we've got to do more to support that. So it's about making sure that we've got the the architecture of the system right. That means we can see the improvements in consistency, see the improvements in health delivery at that front line.
I know Cabinet will be talking about these for the next couple of weeks, but are they going, is DHB restructuring or set up Health New Zealand's the overarching health agency beyond the table as well?
Well, we've indicated that coming out of the Health and Disability System Review report last year and its recommendation for Health NZ, an overarching body, we've accepted in principle that recommendation. That report also recommended reducing the number of DHBs. That's something obviously that we are looking at, but we like the idea of an overarching body to really help drive the performance of the system. The other is the Māori Health Authority. We've committed to having a Māori Health Authority. The issue there is the extent of its powers and reach and you know how it functions within the system to deliver that equity requirement that we really have.
Well, next month's announcements include infrastructure as well? Well, considering recently Dunedin Hospital have said they reached full capacity.
Yeah, well, there's already work underway. I mean, we've got a $1.4 billion build project for Dunedin already approved and about to get underway. And there's a number of projects throughout the hospital network across New Zealand of new buildings going up. I mean, we put this government in the 3.5 years we've been in office has put literally billions of new dollars into upgrading and building new hospital infrastructure. It takes a while for that, A, to get built and B, to come on stream, but we're doing that. In fact, I'm on the North Shore today to commence the construction of a $267 million building for North Shore Hospital. So we put a lot more into that, but it's going to be, you know, 4 or 5 years before a lot of the construction projects that we've approved actually, you know, have an impact on the system.
Right. And once you announce and Cabinet approve these changes, what's next?
Well, then there's a very intense level of engagement with the sector, with as many stakeholders we have to engage with on kind of making the system work. I've been doing meeting a large number of groups and organisations within the health sector over the last few weeks. Talking about this. I mean, everybody is saying, look, they know there needs to be change. They welcome the opportunity for change. They are good about saying, look, you work out what the structure is, how the funding flows, and then we're all going to all work together to pull the moving parts together, if you like, and to make it work. So that'll be what will happen throughout the rest of this year. We'll probably get legislation in the House by the end of the year. And I imagine we'll have the structures sort of up and running partway through next year.
What about changes on specific areas like mental health or cancer that we touched a lot on recent weeks? When can we see announcements around these areas?
Well, on mental health, we have we're rolling out the reform program for that. We committed $1.9 billion to that in 2019. We were due to have spent about $350 million by June this year. We've probably spent about $280 million. The spend on that gets more rapid over the next sort of couple of 3 years. So the mental health and addiction reform process is underway. On cancer, we have the Cancer Control Agency. It's been in place since July last year. It's doing some great work. It's commissioned some great projects on just evaluating where the gaps are in our cancer management regimes, what we need to be doing differently and better. So it'll continue to make do its work and make its recommendations. But I think having a body like Health NZ that has an overarching responsibility for the health system will make it easier to follow through on the sorts of things that I'm expecting to come out of the Cancer Control Agency.
Right. Okay. Moving on to another topic on the Pike River mine. Some families are calling for the Pike River Agency to go further into the mine, but you said on News Up Nation and to Stuff over the past week that's infeasible. Why is that?
Yeah, look, I know that there are some families. It's a small number of families. The vast majority of families have worked together on you know, with the government on this project and with the Parker River Recovery Agency. Just to go back a bit, I mean, I worked very closely with the families very early on in 2018. We took pretty much the whole of 2018, our various experts, including international experts, mapping out this project, seeing what was achievable, what was feasible. The families had their representatives who were involved in pretty much every meeting, got to sit with the experts and the technical experts and the engineers and the coal miners and stuff. And we agreed on what we would do, which was to recover the drift, because we thought that the roof wall, which was 2.3 kilometres into the drift tunnel, that was going to be too technically challenging, both to get through the roof wall and to manage the mine atmosphere, which has been one of the challenges we've had throughout the whole project. I've had to get additional funding to see through this project. We made the commitment to recover the drift. There's a part of the work has been doing the forensic work in conjunction with the police to make sure we're recovering evidence and examining exactly what we're doing. The idea of getting through the roof wall and managing the mine atmosphere and the mine workings is adds considerable extra expense. It is way more hazardous than what we've been doing to date. And look, we've had no serious injury in the project to date, and that was one of the critical criteria that the families put on this whole project. And so we've said, look, we've fulfilled our commitment. That was what we agreed with the families. I can't in good conscience go and spend what would be millions and millions of dollars more to do something that it's not clear it's going to add a lot of extra value. The stuff that the police are doing beyond what they originally intended to do, so they can do their work of putting together the evidence to see if they've got a chance of getting a prosecution. That's what we wanted out of this, and we're getting there, and I can't justify doing anything further.
But surely the government wants to know what caused the explosion, and considering some experts, like Tony Foster, New Zealand's former chief miner, said the reason could lie just 10, 12, 15 metres away. Surely the government wants to know what happened.
Tony Forster's not being accurate when he says that. It's not just 10 or 15 metres away. The roof wall is anywhere from 15 to 50 metres long. And we don't know. He says it's just made up of coal. We just don't know that. He doesn't know that. He actually doesn't know what he doesn't know is his problem. He might have been a former mines inspector, but he hasn't had anything to do with Pike for some years, and he has very limited information that it goes on. What I really worry about is there are some people who say stuff and say it publicly, and they are aware that there are families who are really still struggling to come to terms with their grief on this, and I just think it's an unfortunate thing that some people think it's okay to do. I don't. We've been very open and very clear with the families. They've got every bit of information that the agency has got, and we've made our judgment accordingly. It is simply not correct to say that the best evidence is 15 to 20 metres away. Actually, there's a lot of evidence. The most important area that we had to get to was this area called Pit Bottom and Stone. The forensic examination of that area is happening now. There's a whole lot of plant and equipment in Pit Bottom and Stone that we're in the process of extracting now. The police are going through that with a fine-tooth comb. The extra work the police are doing is to arrange for extra boreholes to be drilled. That's a big task. So they can put cameras down into the areas that we can't get into to examine some of the very areas that Tony Forster says needs to be looked at. So with all due respect to Tony, he actually just doesn't know what he's talking about.
Okay, I'm glad we touched on Pit Bottom and Stone, because that's my final question. So you said the police are now drilling boreholes into Pit Bottom and Stone.
No, sorry. That's not the area. The area that where they're drilling boreholes into is the area further in to the area that goes beyond the roof wall. So it's the area that we can't get to.
Okay, so what's next once this is complete? Is it all finished?
Yeah, well, we've still got weeks to go to clear the Pit Bottom and Stone area. As I say, that's being forensically examined. The plant and equipment that's there is being pulled out. That all has to be examined. Once we've done that, and once the police have finished their part of the process, then the project comes to an end, and we start then the process of handing it back to the Department of Conservation.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
That was indeed Health and Pike River Re-entry Minister Andrew Little, and we talked about the government's potential health sector reform and his comments surrounding recent surrounding the Pike River mine. The time is 38 minutes past 12. You're listening to The Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, on 95BFM. As usual, let me know what you think about what was discussed on the show by the text machine on 5395 or calling in on 3009-3879. But now, let's go for another break. Here is Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division. Welcome back to The Wire. The SkyPath project is all but cancelled, with the New Zealand Transport Agency Waka Kotahi telling cycling advocacy group Bike Auckland that the project has technical problems on how the pathway is supported on the east side of the Harbour Bridge. The path was supposed to connect West Haven in the North Shore, West Haven and North Cove Point in the North Shore. It was included in the government's $6.8 billion New Zealand upgrade program in February last year and had been allocated $360 million, with constructions supposedly scheduled to start at the beginning of this year. I spoke to the group's chair, Bob Cuthbert, about this morning, and I began by asking, what is the project's technical problem?
It's to do with the piers, but I can't tell you any more than that, Justin. I'm afraid it's confidential information that I was given from Waka Kotahi. But think about it. There's the piers. You don't understand the structure of the bridge?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got the piers of the bridge. We've got the actual bridge that was built in 1959, which is a truss structure. And then we've got the clip-ons that were built in 1969, and they are box girders. It's quite important to understand that because Waka Kotahi keep pumping out stories designed to confuse the public. One is that they talk about the truck crash that happened not so long ago. It has nothing to do with building whether you can or can't build SkyPath because the bridge structure, the trusses, aren't affected by the SkyPath proposal at all, even though Waka Kotahi keeps saying they are. And then they keep talking about the clip-ons, which can't take more steel, which is true, they can't. But the SkyPath proposal is supported by the piers. Nothing to do with the clip-ons or the bridge itself. Apart from the fact that both, all these, the clip-ons and the bridge use the piers as well.
Right. But on this decision to delay SkyPath, how do you feel about this?
Hard to express, Justin, because it is such a suspect decision. In 2018, the government told Waka Kotahi to get on with the design. So in 2019, Waka Kotahi launched their design, May, saying this is an amazing design. It's absolutely fit for purpose. It's supported by the piers, so it doesn't have any problems with the clip-ons, which we keep talking about, or any other part of the bridge. So that is fantastic. So in theory, they went away and worked on the project. But now, getting on for 2 years later, and after the spending of a lot of money, we now hear they can't build it because it's something to do with the piers. Now, as I said to you, the piers are used by all parts of the bridge. So you've got to ask yourself, why didn't they check that in the beginning? Right. Why have they done all this work for this amount of time without checking? Is that not wasteful of public money? How much have they spent? Lots of good questions.
And that leads to my next question. Because the SkyPath project has been launched for more than a decade now, and for it to be so close to being cancelled, do you think it has been a waste of resources and time?
Well, no, because you're merging two projects. The first project was actually funded from the public, and that was the original SkyPath, which was hung off the clip-ons. And that was a massive public effort funded by a trust, not by public money as such, and it showed that you could design and get resource consent, which is a really hard thing to do, even getting right through the Environment Court. So that was not wasted time. What has been wasted time is Waka Kotahi taking the project away, saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to use that design at all. We're going to invent our own. 2 years later, it's just money down the drain, money and time. Am I disappointed? I am gutted. This hugely matters because it's at a time when more and more people are biking and trying to get across the harbour from the North Shore. Ferries currently can't cope with the demand. So we've now got the proposal that's come out on the Herald front page today to build a new bridge, different bridge with buses on it as well. That's going to take about a decade. So do you ride a bike, Justin?
Occasionally.
Good. Now that's fine. Okay, so you'd understand if you were told that the vital link for the whole of Auckland is now going to be delayed for a decade. And meanwhile, we continue to build really good cycleways on the city side of the bridge and on the North Shore side. And we're talking about millions and millions of dollars, and yet you can't get across the bridge. Now, that's a public scandal, I think.
Right. But now SkyPath looks all but cancelled. What are the alternative options to achieve being able to take your bike from being able to bike from the North Shore down to the Auckland City Centre?
Well, you mean for the next decade until we wait for the next project to come along?
Or maybe other projects that are there any alternatives rather than using SkyPath that Waka Kotahi can do?
Not really, because it's the narrowest part of the harbour. So if you're going to get across, you've got to get across there. But the problem is, it takes you to West Haven, and that's not where most people want to go. They want to go to downtown so then they can connect up and use all the fabulous cycle paths that branch out from downtown. So that's why right now most people take ferries. But the demand to get across the harbour on ferries has massively outgrown the capability of ferries to cope because, you know, we've got more and more e-bikes. They take twice as much room as a stand bike. We've got more and more e-scooters. We just, more and more people want to get around on this sort of micro-mobility. And yet the systems that we're providing for it are just outdated. Just, you know, Aucklanders, they're just way behind the game.
Right. You recently proposed converting a lane on the Auckland Harbour Bridge into one that's for cycling and walking purposes only. Why do you want that?
Well, can I just say, firstly, it's not for walking because one lane wouldn't allow for people to come and go by mixing up people walking and people biking because it's only 3 metres wide. So the really sad thing is that people won't be able to walk across the bridge, which means we'll be losing out on tourist dollars, but there we go. Anyway, why do I want it? Because I've just told you, we've got massive growing demand for people to get across the bridge. And if we can't build something in the short term, we need to allow something on the existing bridge. It can be done, absolutely can be done, but you just need Waka Kotahi to not create actually fake difficulties. They've just put out a media release saying, no, if you're going to do that, it'll need two lanes because we'll have to provide barriers. But you can do it in the one lane. They're also saying the bridge is too steep. But actually, I wouldn't be rude enough to say they're lying, but they've magically somehow increased the gradient of the bridge by 3%. So, look, there's a huge credibility gap. I'm just sensing that Waka Kotahi actually don't want to help in any way at all. And yet they're currently investing millions in right across New Zealand, but particularly in Auckland, to encourage people to ride a bike. So it really doesn't make sense to me, Justin. I'm absolutely mystified as to why they're being so, I'm not going to say dishonest, but difficult and just, you know, blocking the way for people to get around the city on bikes.
That was Bike Auckland Chair Bath Cuthbert talking about the potential cancellation of the SkyPath project up on the Auckland Harbour Bridge. And the time is just up to 9 to 1. You're listening to the Thursday Wire. We're going on a final break.
Introducing the latest, the greatest, the plant-based patty to make you happy. It's the Nando's Great Pretender.
Flavoured with chilli, garlic, lemon and herbs, the Great Pretender is a high-protein, plant-based patty that's all Nando's, no chicken. Order the Great Pretender today in any burger, pita, wrap, salad, paella, whatever you like. Only at Nando's.
Want to help save people's lives but can't be bothered getting your hands dirty? Good news! The New Zealand Blood Service is setting up a blood drive and all you need to do is join them for a pint. Your shout, of course. From Monday, March 22nd to Friday, March 26th, head to AUT Wellesley Campus Conference Centre to give blood and do your part for the betterment of humanity. Photo ID is essential. For any queries or to book, call 0800 Give Blood. 0800 448 325.
0800 448 325.
And what do you do?
I just go to uni.
Wild. What do you study?
Nah, I don't study.
You teach?
Nah, just go there. Shadows has an extremely legit lunch menu, you know? I'll take you there.
Shadows. Coffee and kitchen from 8, bar from midday with an excellent menu of reasonably priced food. All at a gorgeous new location right in the city centre. Shadows, your student bar, 8 Alfred Street between Prince's and Simon's. Find out what's up. Check out at Shadows Bar NZ on Facebook and Insta.
Sorry, no goths.
Excuse me?
Yeah, piss off. Maybe without those sunnies you could read the bloody sign.
No goths.
This is cruel and unusual.
Not as cruel and unusual as that beautiful velvet cape. Now get out of my sight, Nosferatu.
I'm a human being.
It's hard out there for a goth, but everyone's welcome on Penny's 1 to 4. A heady mix of the sounds of now and the shimmering hits from our alternative past. With Penny, every Monday only on 95 BFM.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā. That's all for the Thursday Rapere Wire today for the 25th of March. Nā te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero me kia mō tēnei rā. Thank you to everyone who spoke to us today. We had Health Minister Andrew Little, Associate Health Minister Dr. Aisha Verrill, Local Government New Zealand's President Stuart Crosby, and Bike Auckland Chair Barb Cuthbert. Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Also, a big thank you to all of you who tuned in, called in, and sent in texts. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. We will be back next week. I'm now handling you to the 124 with Sigrid. Enjoy your week. Mā te wā.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.